Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
Just maybe a little bit of a background. I did suggest this topic for the Thomistic Institute, right? They ask you to submit talks that you can give and are interested in giving. And I always find that this is really a topic that all of us have at least been in contact with, well, at least at some point in your life, be it, you know, over, I don't know, debating your favorite movie with your friend or going to a museum and seeing something very beautiful and being awestruck by it, or seeing something really ugly and being awestruck by that. So I want to, hopefully I'm going to elucidate a couple of things. I will have to say I'm going to talk about quite a plethora of things. So it's all right if you don't understand all of them. But I'm hoping that the main point will come through towards the end. So that just as a brief introductory note. So, never lose an opportunity of seeing anything beautiful, for beauty is God's handwriting. Ralph Waldo Emerson. Once upon a time, an emperor hired two cunning weavers who claimed they could create the most exquisite garments ever seen, so fine indeed they would be invisible to anyone too simple or unfit for their position to admire. Intrigued by the idea of a fabric that could test the subject's competence, the emperor paid them handsomely. The weavers set up looms and pretended to work day and night, weaving invisible cloth. Courtiers sent to check on their progress saw nothing, but terrified of being labeled foolish or unworthy, they reported back to the stunning beauty of the non-existing fabric. Finally, the emperor himself inspected the clothes. Though he saw nothing, he too pretended to admire the garments, fearing others would think him unfit to rule. The day of the grand procession arrived, and the emperor, dressed in his invisible finery, paraded through the city streets. The crowd, equally afraid of looking foolish, lavished praise on the emperor's splendor. Then a small child cried out, "But he's wearing nothing at all." The spell was broken, and the people began to laugh. Though the emperor suspected the truth, his pride kept him from acknowledging it, and he continued the procession more humiliated than ever. Hans Christian Andersen's famous tale of the emperor's new clothes illustrates in a unique and insightful way why it matters that beauty does not lie only in the eye of the beholder. Yet the modern insistence that beauty depends only on personal perception, individual taste, and is based solely on the judgment of the audience remains. So my little retelling of the story points our attention and wants to point our attention also to another troubling side of the equation, which is the weavers. When beauty is set as purely subjective, it actually opens the door to manipulation, groupthink, peer pressure, and ultimately a self-imposed disconnect from reality. If beauty is merely a matter of perception, people, those who are afraid to speak their mind and their true feeling towards it, feel pressure to conform to others' opinions, even when these opinions are baseless or false. Yet, as we behold a majestic landscape, marvel at the architectural harmony of a Gothic cathedral, or lose ourselves in a vivid painting, we're engaging in a timeless experience of humanity and a timeless experience of beauty. And we recognize precisely that. Beauty is not just subjective, but is universal, objective, and even transcendent. So the dual nature of the experience, that beauty depends on the personal taste, and that beauty is objective and universal, opens our question for the evening. Are things that we call beautiful, beautiful in themselves, or do they only become beautiful by us calling them beautiful? The stakes in answering this question are significant. If beauty is merely subjective, then I am the sole arbiter of beauty. Beauty becomes something ephemeral and indeed fleeting. Moreover, if beauty is only measured by my liking, then in fact the ugliest thing can be beautiful if I just deem it to be so. And last but not least, if all is potentially beautiful, then nothing actually is. So let's ask, can beauty in a subjective world still be considered objective? And what I want to do is I give you a little bit of a historical background, which culminates in Aquinas, and then I'm give you a little bit more historical background from modernity, and then I'll apply all of the principles that we learn in our short historical discourse. So let's begin with Plato. In Plato, undisputedly the founding figure of Western philosophy, we discover that beauty was not treated in an isolated fashion, but rather was an integral part of a broader metaphysical and ethical framework. For Plato, the term beauty, kalon, transcends mere physical allure. It embodies moral goodness, ideal perfection, and indeed the essence of universal harmony. Nowhere is this better embodied than in Diotima's speech about the ladder of love in the Symposium. Quote, "This is what it is to go aright, or be led by another, into the mystery of love. One goes always upwards for the sake of this beauty, starting from beautiful things here and ascending ever upwards by way of one or two and two to all beautiful bodies, from beautiful bodies to beautiful practices, and from beautiful practices to beautiful forms of knowledge, until from these one arrives finally at that knowledge which is knowledge of nothing other than beauty, the beautiful itself, so that in the end one comes to know it as it is in itself." End quote. Beauty in this philosophy operates then on two dimensions. There is a horizontal axis, we could call it that, representing manifestations in the material and the crafted, the artistic world, and there's a vertical axis, signifying the ascendance of beautiful things to the beautiful form. So that leads you to beauty itself. The relation between the material and the spiritual itself is beautiful. So you have a horizontal axis, you have a vertical axis, and you have the relation of the two, which in itself is also beautiful. So for the moment, then what we pick up from Plato is two points. Number one, that beauty and goodness, ethical rectitude, are linked, maybe even similar, maybe even identical. And two, that the attempt in seeking beauty is not a vain endeavor. But Plato goes even further. In his dialogue, The Timaeus, Plato elaborates on beauty through the lens of proportion and order, which he considers fundamental to the very structure of the universe. He proposes that the cosmos itself, crafted by divine cause, reflects an exquisite balance and harmony. This is achieved through the blending of elemental forces, such as fire, earth, water, and air, in precise mathematical ratios. This harmony is not merely physical, but profoundly metaphysical, bringing the divine between the visible and the invisible, as the cause of order, the soul and body, if you will, and thus even showing that that even the human has something divine in it. Beauty in this sense becomes an expression of the cosmic order, both aesthetic and ontological, revealing the perfect unity underlying apparent multiplicity. Quote, "For God desired that, as far as possible, all things should be good and nothing evil, wherefore, when he took over all that was visible, not in a state of rest, but in discordant and disorderly motion, he brought it into order, considering that order was in every way better than disorder." End quote. David Schindler notes in his thoughtful analysis that order and harmony are not static constructs for Plato, but indeed dynamic manifestations of unity within multiplicity. The coincidence of opposites, which is a theme embedded in the Symposium, illustrates how beauty often arises from the tension between contrasting elements, for example, poverty and wealth, the body and the soul, the finite and the infinite. This interplay reflects the paradoxical nature of beauty. It is transcendent, yet immanent, absolute yet dialectical, in the classical sense, fully present in a single manifestation, yet pointing beyond itself to a higher reality. And one more element remains to be named in Plato. For Plato, Eros, as portrayed in the Symposium, is the driving force behind the human pursuit of beauty. It is a daimon embodying the human desire to transcend physical limitations and unite with the eternal. Underlining that beauty arises from a tension between contrasting elements. Eros is born of poros, resourcefulness, and penia, poverty. Thus, the longing for beauty is not only a quest for physical gratification, but rather a philosophical striving aimed at achieving immortality. Like Plato, Aristotle links the beautiful kalon to ethics, and thus aesthetics and human happiness. Kalon, something that he calls the fine, the admirable, and the beautiful, is tied to practical realities of life and of virtuous action. So in this reflection, we get an additional element for our consideration. Aristotle identifies the kalon as the object and motive of virtuous action. So courage, which is a central virtue for Aristotle, is characterized by enduring fear and then taking appropriate action for the sake of the kalon, of the beautiful. So the kalon is a teleological principle guiding individuals towards actions that harmonize reason, moral intent, and aesthetic harmony, aesthetic beauty. In the realm of art, Aristotle extends this principle to a pivotal concept, which is the mimesis, imitation. So art for Aristotle is a process of imitating life, not as mere replication, but as an interpretation that reveals deeper truths about the human condition. This dynamic process imbues art with a unique kalon, a structured beauty that resonates with human experiences of symmetry, proportion, and emotional catharsis. And we have very much lost the sense of imitation, and I can give a very simple, maybe experiment, maybe it's not so simple, but an experiment nonetheless, is think about how you would answer the following question. What is the opposite of natural? And if you answer by saying artificial, then we have a problem, because every work of art is artificial. So the work of art that you place then in opposite to nature. For Aristotle, and for Thomas, and for most of the ancients, the artificial is not the opposite of the natural. It is a continuation of the natural, because it is both based in logos. It's logical. We would say it makes sense. Right? So the opposite of natural is the illogical, that which doesn't make sense. Okay. So, has a bunch of complicated Greek metaphysics for you. Thomas Aquinas. Aquinas, synthesizing Platonic and Aristotle and their principles with Christian theology, expands the kalon into the realm of divine contemplation. For Aquinas, beauty's defining traits, and he has three, integrity, proportion, and clarity, reflect the divine order and invite the observer to a transcendent experience of God. This theological extension underscores the universal and metaphysical dimension of the kalon, linking it to the ultimate truth about existence. Thomas Aquinas synthesized classical ideas with Christian theology to formulate a comprehensive theory of beauty. Aquinas identifies the three primary components of beauty, integritas as wholeness, something has to be whole in order to be beautiful, nothing should be lacking, as consonantia, which is proportion, so something has to be proportionate in itself and to its surroundings, very important for architecture, and claritas, probably the most difficult, radiance. It has to have some kind of, it emanates some kind of attractive aura, to use an anachronistic word. So Aquinas acknowledges beauty as a transcendental property of being, co-equal with unity, truth, and goodness, thus situating it as an intrinsic and inalienable aspect of all existence. Whenever God in Genesis said it is good, he may as well also have said it is beautiful. Far from a contingent or subjective quality, beauty then reflects the ontological structure of reality itself, rooted in the divine order of creation. Aquinas elucidates beauty as the harmonization of formal perfection and the intelligibility that renders it perceptible. By engaging with beauty, the human intellect transcends the material and ascends towards the divine, encountering in the act of contemplation a reflection of God's intelligible essence. There's something interesting implied in this, which is rooted in Genesis, that the artist's creation of a work of art is the result of some kind of creative urge, right? Some kind of drive, right? And when you speak to artists, often they will say that, like, you have, you know, fancy ways of saying it, such as, you know, being kissed by the muse, right? But it just, they need to do it. Something drives them to do it. And it could be a poet having the drive to write down an experience in beautiful language and then probably rewrite it till he's saying, that's exactly the expression of what I felt. Or it's an artist discovering a beautiful form and putting it in the matter that he's working with, in the material that he's working with. So there's a certain fruitfulness, and that has been laid into creation by God when he said, be fruitful and multiply. So there is an urge in creation that specifically is tied to beauty. So, in the synthesis of Thomistic metaphysics, beauty emerges not only as an aesthetic ideal, but as an ontological structure of reality, and indeed an epistemic conduit to the divine. It is through contemplation that production of beauty that human beings access a participatory insight into divine order, apprehending the eternal through the finite. Thus, beauty has become the locus where metaphysical, theological, and the creative dimension converge, offering a profound articulation of the ultimate purpose of existence. Right. Just to sum up all of what I've just said, from our historical survey we have learned, beauty reveals itself both as a material phenomenon and a transcendent quality, uniting physical harmony with profound metaphysical reality. Rooted in notions of proportion, integrity, and clarity, beauty aligns with the cosmic order and reveals the intelligibility of existence, serving as a reflection of the unity inherent in creation. It operates as a guiding principle in ethical action, a harmonizing force in art, and a transforming experience that elevates the human being and the human spirit. Beauty transcends utility, embodying a purposive drive towards harmony, intelligibility, and the infinite. In contemplating or in making beauty, humans access a participatory insight into a reality that transcends the material, pointing ultimately to divine harmony. All right. So having said all of that, why are we in the place where we are? Well, it all starts with a turn towards the subject. Immanuel Kant's philosophy of art marks a significant departure from previous philosophical musings, particularly in two key aspects. There are more, but I want to focus on two. By investigating the uniqueness of the aesthetic judgment of you calling something beautiful and how it comes about that you call something beautiful in a judgment, he firstly emphasizes that the judgment of beauty is based on a subjective experience devoid of practical interest, as he outlines in his Critique of Judgment. Beauty for Kant arises from, quote, the form of purposiveness in an object so far as it is perceived without the representation of an end. End quote. So, in short, a judgment of art lives for its own sake. It doesn't have an ulterior end. So it's a disinterested pleasure that is free from personal utility or moral purpose. You like a work of art, a beautiful work of art, not because you want it to be hung in your living room, but because it is beautiful and you describe it, you judge it as beautiful. Okay. But there is something different as well, the second characteristic. Because the aesthetic judgment is set against the moral judgment for Kant, which by nature is universal, because it has the form of law, the judgment of taste is also universal, meaning that whenever you call something beautiful, you claim that and you call for a universal assent grounded in a shared human sensibility or common sense. So by judging something as beautiful, I imply that you should judge it as beautiful as well. And maybe that does explain some of the dogmatism which we display when, well, we discuss our favorite movie or favorite, you know, I don't know, work of music, a piece of music. Quote, everyone must admit that a judgment about beauty demands the agreement of everyone, although no one has the right to coerce others into this agreement. End quote. So there's a paradoxical nature of beauty then. It is subjective, but it is also universally communicable. And this is what Kant underscores. What is interesting is that Kant then relies on a sort of a common sense that inherently underpins the social nature of the aesthetic judgment. So it demands universal agreement despite it being rooted in subjective feelings. And this is a paradox that he does not really resolve. And what's more interesting is that if that is actually the case, then where is the common ground, as the Germans would say, between the subjective judgment that I speak and the universal adherence that I demand? For Kant, it's relatively easy. It's the structure of reason, which he obviously dedicates a great deal of his work to. Good. But you still have to ask, well, if beauty is not rooted in the thing itself, then how can there be agreement? That's one shift. The second shift is Kant's insistence on genius. Genius for Kant is not, and genius is a relatively, well, recent term, right? It rises mostly in the Renaissance, specifically in Italy, specifically under Vasari, who writes all of the biographies of the great artists that we all know and love. But genius is not really something that, in that form, was proposed by the ancients. Skillful artistry could be learned, and has nothing to do with genius. You can practice it, you can learn it, you can acquire it. Okay. In Kant, genius is still, transformed into something else yet. The genius for Kant is not the skillful master of an art, but a person open to some kind of intuition. So the shift of the understanding of genius goes from something that is materially manifested in a very skillful painter, for example, to something intellectual, somebody who's open for an intuition. And for Kant, even more, artistic genius transcends rule-bound craftsmanship as it operates beyond conscious adherence to artistic principles. Genius, as a natural capacity, enables the artist to create beautiful works without explicitly knowing why they're beautiful and why they are original. And good, well, see, AI agrees, so I can't, I can't be wrong, that's good. They will send a Terminator to take me out in the future. But since it is natural, since the genius is born and is natural, that means that some people have it, they're natural born artists, and others don't and cannot acquire it. And so, maybe it's surprising to you, but with these two elements, Kant's philosophy of art delineates a tectonic shift in aesthetic thought through its emphasis on the autonomy in the aesthetic judgment and the decoupling of universality in the aesthetic judgment and the role of artistic genius. Right. So much for the philosophical background, and we can elaborate more in the questions. Now, all of this happens before the background of, well, art history and how that develops. And so I want to focus on that for a moment. The Viennese art historian Hans Sedlmayr delineates the decline of art since roughly the 1750s in a very peculiar analysis, a symptomatic analysis. He's the doctor of the history of art. And the symptomatic analysis shows that the whole, the unified artistic work, the Gesamtkunstwerk, became fragmented. And this fragmentation is rooted and unfolds in two interdependent movements. The first is that each art form seeks to discover its own elemental core, its essence, in the self-reflexive opposition to all others, and subsequently fragments one discipline of art from the harmony of all of the others, and especially the others that were historically integrated into a unified expression. So, this movement is obviously not linear and does have some exceptions, but generally speaking, I think this is true. And so the first part of this is the fragmentation of art through the search for its essence. Sedlmayr identifies the modernist obsession with uncovering the essence of each artistic discipline as a primary cause of art. He argues that this pursuit of the purity within each medium, painting, music, sculpture, and architecture, has led to the erosion of the expressive range and the reduction to technical exercises. For example, paintings embrace of flatness and color become ends in themselves and do not serve anymore the narrative and representational depth of, well, a painting. Quote, "Each art, driven by the pursuit of its own essence, severed its ties to the others, relinquishing the interconnectedness that had once imbued artistic creation with greater meaning." End quote. So what is this supposed purity that art seeks to achieve? By isolating the unique characteristics of each medium, modernism pursued a self-referential technical exercise that focused exclusively on the respective different elements in painting, sculpture, and architecture. What initially began as a drill and creative exaggeration and isolation in each individual medium was formalized by the negative tension against all other elements, thus fragmenting the art discipline within itself. So, analogous to the fragmentation of reality in modern times, in which, for example, each empirical science turns every part of reality into the whole and claims full knowledge of that reality, art forms strove for fragmentation by isolating themselves from each other. So I can give you three examples. There are many. The first would be in painting. Abstract expressionism and minimalism. So in those movements, in abstract expressionism and minimalism, purity manifests in the abandonment of representational content, focusing instead of color, shape, and texture. For example, Mark Rothko's color field paintings reduce the medium to fields of color meant to evoke emotion while avoiding figurative representation. Right? Similarly, Pierre Mondrian's grids in works like composition with red, blue, and yellow epitomized the reduction of painting to geometric abstraction, eschewing symbolism or narrative. Another example would be music. There is the 12-tone technique and serialism. So composers like Arnold Schoenberg and Anton Weber exemplify the quest for purity through serialism. They reduce music to strictly mathematical principles governing pitch, rhythm, and dynamics, so as to explore the essence of musical structure. But what this led to was works that prioritized intellectual formalism over, well, melody or emotional resonance, in fact alienating the audience. And the third example would be architecture. And their good example would just be modernism or functionalism, where in art, the principle form follows function underscores the pursuit of this purity. Structures like Le Corbusier's Ville Savoy or Gropius's Bauhaus reflect the adherence to minimalist aesthetics and alleged functionality. They reject ornamentation, they reject symbolic elements, and, in fact, traditional craftsmanship. And thus, these works select clean lines, utility, often at the expense of the human element, historical and traditional forms, and, of course, transcendent beauty. What I think makes this more problematic is that most of the functionalist architecture ends up not being functional at all. Just take a house to live in. The function of a living house is to be a home. So, the result of this fragmentation is the loss of the unified work of art. Each discipline becomes its standalone against all of the others, and thus dismantle the whole work of art, the Gesamtkunstwerk, the total work of art. This fragmentation reflects and indeed accelerates the broader dissolution of an integrated worldview in modernity. Man, one situated within a universe imbued with spiritual meaning and harmonious order, now finds himself in a fragmented, alienated, and estranged state from nature, his fellow human beings, and ultimately God. Quote, "The decline of art mirrors the broader dissolution of unity in the modern world. Its fragmentation is symptomatic of the loss of a center that once unified both culture and spirit." End quote. A new era of godlessness and subjectivity. The 20th century marks a dramatic acceleration in the trajectory of this fragmentation, fueled not only by the world wars, but also by the cultural revolution of the 1968 movement and the institutionalized cultural Marxism, triumphing in many places in the last decades. Intriguingly, the way towards destruction of art had a decisively philosophical slant. It was enacted by redefining art as art theory. In fact, reducing art to art theory. So modern art became a fundamentally literary exercise, with paintings reduced to visual appendages of written theory. Movements such as Fauvism and Futurism epitomized this break. Georges Braque's Cubism prioritized the pictorial fact over anecdotal representation, while Frank Stella's famous assertion, "What you see is what you see," abandoned narrative entirely for the sake of form. The result was an art that detached itself from emotional resonance or historical continuity, favoring self-contained aesthetics. So the inward turn led to abstract expressionism's dominance, guided by art critics like Clement Greenberg and Harold Rosenberg, for example. Greenberg's emphasis on flatness as the defining essence of painting and Rosenberg's dramatic action painting characterized the era. Jackson Pollock's frenetic splashes of paint became emblematic of the artist's inner psyche, elevating process over visual coherence. Theorists and critics effectively positioned themselves as gatekeepers of meaning, transforming art into a theoretical contest. The studio became a battleground of ideation rather than craftsmanship. In April 1970, an artist named Lawrence Weiner typed up a work that appeared in the Arts magazine and was quoted by Tom Wolfe. This piece had no visual experience before or after whatsoever. And it goes like this. 1. The artist may construct a piece. 2. The piece may be fabricated. 3. The piece need not be built. Each being, equal and consistent with the intent of the artist, the decision as to condition rests with the receiver upon the occasion of receivership. End quote. And Wolf comments, quote, art made its final flight, climbed higher and higher in an ever-decreasing, tighter-turning spiral until, with one last erg of freedom, one last dendritic synapse, it disappeared up in its own fundamental aperture and came out the other side as art theory. Art theory, pure and simple. Words on a page. Literature undefiled by vision, flat, flatter, flattest, a vision invisible, even ineffable as the angels and the universal souls. End quote. So, a new beginning, question mark? Don't worry, these are my last 3 points. And they're short. If we want a new beginning in art and in aesthetic and theory of beauty, then I think there are 3 factors that we need to focus on. The first is art in relation to creative intuition. Artistic intuition ascends beyond the limitations of conceptual thought to inhabit the exalted realm of the non-conceptual spiritual sense, a domain where reality resonates directly and profoundly with the essence of the soul, unmediated by abstraction. Maritain calls this the translucid spiritual night of the unconscious, and he calls it not merely a passive reservoir of latent cognition or Freudian impulses, rather it is a luminous and generative fountainhead where intellect and imagination intertwine in an ineffable and primal unity. It is here, in this preconceptual crucible, that poetic intuition finds its genesis, a luminous intellective act that neither aspires nor culminates in the formation of concepts, but instead embodies, quote, a fully determined intellective form enveloped in the night of the spiritual unconscious, end quote. Such intuition transcends the mechanistically perceived pathways of rational cognition, advancing instead through knowledge by effective union, wherein the poet, in an indivisible act of creation, awakens both self and the world from the slumber of inert potentiality. What does that mean? That means that the artist allows the world to show him what it truly is, and with this intuition, he can present that to the audience. So that would be a counter thesis to Kant's genius. Point number 2, art is the artificial, but not opposed to nature. Art, as described in this presentation, is not opposed to artificiality, but represents rather a continuation of nature's process, rooted in the harmonious interplay of form and matter under the governance of reason. It is indeed an intellectual virtue, where the practical intellect brings speculative knowledge to life, impressing rational forms onto material objects. Both are necessary, knowledge and skill. This mirrors nature's intrinsic operations, where form guides the matter towards fulfillment and positions art as a natural extension of human intellect and creativity. And also in this, the artist's creativeness is closely linked and mirrored, mirroring divine action. And thus, third, art in the service of form. So, if we want to have a corrective measure against the modern aberrations of art, we need to go back to and revisit the Aristotelian mimesis, imitation. Imitation is not a slavish replication of surface appearances, but is the imitation of nature's deeper structural order and inherent purpose. As Piero di Cosimo discovered through his imaginative engagement with accidental patterns in nature, such patterns on a wall transforming it into fantastical imaginary, so too can the artist find in nature a germinal form that invites the shaping power of the spirit. So the artist's challenge is to discern and articulate the forms latent in nature, allowing them to emerge through disciplined intuition and, well, technical mastery. Good. Those are my 3 points as a solution. Lots of food for thought, I'm sure. Now, I have done the philosopher thing, which is I asked a question that I did not answer. Which is there objective beauty in a subjective world? So let me try to give you an answer to that question, okay, before we go to questions. The quest for objective beauty reflects a profound alienation. The separation of the object from the subject and the subject's deep longing to reunite with the object. For the medieval theologian, and this is not the only feature that warrants emulation, beauty was deeply rooted in reality. It was an intrinsic part of reality. And indeed, as a transcendental, it was reality. This is not only the case because they saw in creation a reflection of God, but also because they sought in creation all that is beautiful. And this is necessary because not everything in reality is beautiful. Death is not beautiful. Decay is not beautiful. Sickness is not beautiful. Yet, beauty can be discerned even amidst sickness, death, and decay, and all of the other ugliness of human existence, when these realities are viewed in the proper light. So the responsibility of viewing them in the proper light is the very casting of light. And that should be done. The exaltation of cell's sacrificial death, for example, the celebration of human resilience in the face of illness, and the discovery of the spiritual within a decaying world. So, my answer to the question of whether beauty is objective or subjective is ultimately misguided, because it begins with a false dichotomy. Object and subject are not separate. In reality, they are one. The work of art and the viewer are both part of reality, participating in being. Once we understand their unity, we can focus on what they share, their similitude, and how God is the cause of it, and presents and present in all of it. God is present in nature, God is present in the human intellect, and in the order that is achieved with real artistic skill. So, we ought no longer speak of objective and subjective beauty, but simply of beauty. And, as is true for every age, much remains to be done. So I want to close with an insightful citation from Hans-Urs von Balthasar. We no longer dare to believe in beauty and make of it a mere appearance in order to more easily dispose of it. Our situation today shows that beauty demands for itself at least as much courage and decision as do truth and goodness, and she will not allow herself to be separated and banned from her two sisters without taking them along with her in an act of mysterious vengeance. We can be sure that whoever sneers at her name, at beauty's name, as if she were the ornament of a bourgeois past, whether he admits it or not, can no longer pray and soon will no longer be able to love. End quote. So this brings us back to the child in the crowd gazing at the naked emperor. Perhaps now we can better grasp our Lord's words when he said, "Truly I tell you, unless you change and become like little children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven." It is the courage of the child that we need, the courage to stand against the lies of our age, to call out the vainglorious emperor and his cunning weavers. Only then can we summon true beauty to its rightful place. As we say in German, Kinder und Besoffene sagen die Wahrheit. Children and drunks always tell the truth. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.